This is Jim Inkster. Coming next on Talk Louisiana, we will visit with Raymond Strother, the veteran Hall of Fame political consultant who's handled the campaigns of Bill Clinton, Gary Hart, Al Gore, and many others. He'll comment on the retirement of the U.S. Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy after 30 years on the high court. What does this mean, and what are the implications to a state like Louisiana with the swing vote now probably going to be occupied by a solid conservative on just about every vote if things go as they did with Justice Neil Gorsuch. Also, Steve Kearney of Fair Districts Louisiana on the Supreme Court decision this week regarding gerrymandering, and journalist Ken Oletta of The New Yorker. His latest work is about the ad business, Frenemies, the epic disruption of the ad business, and everything else. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757 if you'd like to join the conversation. And in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. You can send an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. Ali Baltazar is producing, and we begin today with the esteemed political consultant, the Hall of Famer Ray Strother, who's handled candidates far and wide for many years, now living in Montana with his beautiful wife, Sandy. And he is joining us on a day in which we were scheduled to talk about other things, but now, with the retirement of Justice Anthony Kennedy, that supersedes just about anything else and has major implications for the country as a whole and for a state like Louisiana. Good morning, Ray Strother.
Good morning, Jim.
What do you think, Ray Strother, Justice Kennedy was considered to be and was the swing vote on many cases. Most of the time he sided with the conservative majority on the court, but not always, and particularly on gay rights and women's rights. He had a record that some conservatives didn't like. It would seem that most likely his successor would be more conservative than he is.
Well, he's like Sandra Day O'Connor. She did the same sort of thing. Occasionally, she would vote with the opposition. But you know what this really says is presidential elections have consequence. And when Trump was elected, it wasn't just a thumb in the eye of the opposition. It was going to have serious consequences for America. And this is one way. There's a possibility he will get a second or third. He's already had one nominee, but he will get a third Supreme Court justice. It's very possible. We have Ginsburg, who's, what, 82 or 83 years old, something like that.
And Breyer.
So this could go on and on, and the court will be changed for the life of my grandchildren.
And that has implications. It seems that after 45 years, we are now looking at the real possibility. It's no longer a strategy, but a real possibility that Roe v. Wade will be overturned, and a state like Louisiana, and perhaps the entire country, but certainly Louisiana, abortion accessibility will be unavailable to any citizens of our state.
Yeah, women's health will be in great danger, I think. Also, things like affirmative action. There are a lot of things that could be reversed. And I think, as I said, I think we'll be suffering consequences of this for a long time. Now, I guess if you're a conservative and you want to do away with Roe Wade and you want to do away with affirmative action and you want to turn back the clock on a lot of things, this may be good news. What's going to happen, though, is interesting. This is going to happen right as the midterm elections start heating up. They start heating up September 1. We never spent much money till then. And they start heating up. And I don't know yet how people will react. Will this turn out the right wing, where they were a little lackadaisical before? Or will this turn out the left? I think it'll have consequences in the midterm, depending on how it develops, how the hearings go in the Senate.
877-217-5757 or talk@talklouisiana.org for Ray Strother, the Hall of Fame political consultant. In so many halls of fame that it's hard to keep track, and wrote one of the best memoirs about his life and times, Falling Up, and it is quite a read. Now, yesterday, Senator John Neely Kennedy says, "I congratulate Justice Kennedy, I presume no relation, for serving on the U.S. Supreme Court for more than 30 years and wish him well on his retirement. Serving on the nation's highest court is a pinnacle reached by few and requires true dedication to public service. We owe him a sincere thank you. As a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, I look forward to sitting down with President Trump's nominee and asking some tough questions. I will be looking for someone of great intellect who has more than a passing fondness for the U.S. Constitution and doesn't think personal preferences have a role in judicial decision-making. In short," writes Senator Kennedy, "I'm hoping Justice Gorsuch has a brother or a sister who's willing to serve." Now, Justice Gorsuch has proved to be, in his 1 year on the court, the most conservative member of the court. And that would seem, it would seem that Senator Kennedy is not looking for somebody with an open mind. He's looking for a conservative ideologue.
Well, I think that's true. The conservatives have an opportunity they haven't had in a lifetime, but something they've been campaigning for as long as I can remember. And I've been doing this since about 1967, I think. And this has been going on. Remember the old faded billboards that hung around for a long time, "Impeach Earl Warren"? The court has always been a center of controversy, and it will continue to be so. And if this president appoints two conservatives, it'll have a major impact on America, for the life of my grandchildren, not for me, but for the life of my grandchildren.
Now, Mitch McConnell upheld the nomination of Merrick Garland for more than a year when Justice Scalia died. It was Garland who was nominated by President Obama. Justice Kennedy, by the way, was installed on the court in the final year of Ronald Reagan's presidency, very analogous to Merrick Garland. And a Democratic majority in the Senate at that time voted for Kennedy. But in this case, Mitch McConnell upheld the nomination of Merrick Garland, saying that it would be unfair to vote on him with an election coming up. Now, the same senator from Kentucky, Mitch McConnell, is saying that we have to vote now on whomever President Trump nominates. Is there an inconsistency there?
I was very amused when he said we must give whoever Trump wants a fair hearing, and we shouldn't let this be a hearing of discord. That is remarkable he would say something like that after what he did. Now, the problem with Democrats have is they can protest all they want, but the Republicans have a majority in the Senate. And I think only two votes would be in question, and McConnell has great power to bring pressure on those two women who might vote against the nominee.
Well, we will see, but Justice Anthony Kennedy leaving and a successor coming on has great implications, and for a state like Louisiana has stated, there will probably be no more legal abortion in the state within a year or two, and Governor John Bel Edwards, who's a Democrat, I'm sure would gladly sign a bill into law doing just that. A listener, Tracy at the Capitol, asked Raymond Strother, are we going to see a move to undo same-sex marriage? It would seem now that the votes are there to do just that on the high court if they get a case that would relate to that. What do you think?
I think there might be a move on that. However, that is already so ingrained in American culture. I think justices would be a little hesitant to do anything involving gay marriage or gay rights. I may be wrong. They may be so conservative they will go after that too. But I think that would be lower on their agenda because they'd be flying in the face of popular American opinion. And they normally don't do that.
877-217-5757, and the court has been busy this week. A decision on gerrymandering, a decision on labor unions, and if not for the retirement yesterday of Justice Kennedy, that would have been front page story. Instead, the labor decision is largely buried, but many believe that this is the death knell for labor unions in our country. Ray Strother.
I think so, too. I've heard some labor people say that we've just begun to fight, but this is a very serious setback for them. But, you know, this Supreme Court is changing things. For example, when they allowed no limit on contributions to political parties, It changed everything about political campaigns. There are now campaigns where more money is spent outside the campaign by outsiders than in the campaign by the campaign staff. So it's changed the nature of American politics, and not for the best. Money is at the root of all evil in American politics, believe me. And this Supreme Court, I think, has done great damage, and that's one example.
The court decision yesterday regarding unions is particularly interesting for teacher unions. The New York Times writes, the nation's highest court decided Wednesday that they and other public sector unions can no longer collect agency fees, which are currently mandatory in 22 states. The ruling comes after the unions racked up a series of victories early this year, and now teacher unions could lose up to a third of their members. And we'll talk about this and more with Ray Strother. Your number 877-217-5757, and the email is talk@talklouisiana.org. And before we go to the break, teacher unions losing a third of their members, we have two very big teacher unions in Louisiana, LFT and LAE, and I would imagine at this point they're assessing this decision from the high court, Ray Strother.
Oh, I think so, too. And teachers are so low paid. If somebody who's in desperate straits for money is given an opportunity to get another $30 or $40, I don't know what the dues might be, $30 or $40 a month, they would probably tend to let their union dues sag, ignoring the long-term consequence. But I think it will drastically harm unions and the union's power in the electorate.
Well, we will talk more with the esteemed Raymond Strother, who is now joining us from his home in Bozeman, Montana. Longtime professor, by the way, at Northwestern State University, in addition to everything else he's done in his long and distinguished career. We'll be back after this pause. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar's producing, and Raymond Strother's our guest for a while longer, the longtime political consultant who cut his teeth in Louisiana before political consulting was cool. He went to Washington, D.C. in 1980 and became the most prominent Democratic consultant in that city. And at the time you went 38 years ago, Ray, there were probably, I'm just guessing, fewer than 50 political consultants in that town at the time?
In Washington, actually on the Democratic side there were four of us, and on the Republican side about six. Prominent Democratic consultants were in New York and Washington, but the total couldn't have been half a dozen, or maybe exaggerating 10. It was a lovely time for a new political consultant.
Yeah.
We had no competition.
Lou Ann, yeah, now, of course, there may be hundreds, if not thousands, of consultants on the streets of D.C. Lou Ann writes, your guest Quinn Hillier yesterday mentioned that you don't have to pay dues to Kiwanis if you don't want to join. That's true enough, but you can't just walk into a Kiwanis luncheon meeting and eat their lunch. If the benefits of decent and safe working conditions benefit you through a union-negotiated contract at your job, of course you should pay your share. What do you think, Ray Strother?
Well, you know, my father, who was a laborer, worked for Gough Oil in Port Arthur, when he would give me wisdom on his knee, said that working people didn't have a chance, that the powers, the big money, the powers in government had all the control. And the only control a labor man could have or a labor woman could have is banding together in one unit. And he would use the old trick of breaking one stick easily, then putting 20 sticks together and you can't break them. And he said, we have to do that. We have no choice, because we have no voice. And teachers are going to find themselves that way, too. They have no choice. They're already too low paid. They should all get 50% tax raises right now. I mean, there's no question that we trust our children to people who are low paid. I think we should pay teachers more. But now, without the power to negotiate, they are really, really going to be in a bad position. And the consequence is wider than that. Then we'll have fewer teachers. People will avoid education. And it ripples throughout society, in my opinion.
877-217-5757. Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Ray Strother.
Yeah, Mr. Strother, does the controversy surrounding the selection of federal judges the Citizens United decision, and the money being poured in the lobbyist input on legislation show that we not only have the best Congress that money can buy, but also the best judiciary.
How does the Citizens United decision affect the composition of the judiciary?
First, I wish I could have said it as well as our guest just did, our caller just did. He was very eloquent in that because he summed it all up. You know, you can't, in politics, you can't separate one thing. The judiciary is here and it's aside from politics. It isn't. We got the last conservative justice because of a president being elected narrowly by the electoral vote, not the popular vote. And so money helped him. Outside money helped him. Russia helped him. Let's be honest. I think that's pretty well proven now. Russia helped him. So anytime you have big money, they can help control elections, and the elections have results. The result would be Supreme Court justices. More than that, there are justices or judges being appointed all over this country that people ignore that are just as conservative or more than conservative than anybody but Clarence Thomas.
Tommy downtown. Tommy, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Raymond Strother.
Good morning, Ray. Tommy, downtown Baton Rouge. Congratulations to your son, Dane, on the victory in Mississippi with David Beria for U.S. Senate. I was hoping you could give us some thoughts on John Bel Edwards' chances against maybe John Kennedy for governor in a couple years.
Next year, as in 15 months. 15 months, believe it or not.
Wow, Tommy. Congratulations. Let's talk about congratulating my son rather than this other subject. I think it'd be much easier to do. Yeah, he did a great job over there and elected an underdog in the Democratic primary. Now, let's get back to John Bel Edwards, who deserves to be reelected. However, Louisiana is a red, crimson red state now. Trump's approval in Louisiana is huge, and Trump will play a part. These future elections are going to be whether you're with Trump or against Trump, I think. So Kennedy's playing it pretty carefully, I think. He's become sort of a character on camera in Washington. I'm amused by him. But he's a very articulate and very bright man. It's the worst opponent I think Edwards could draw. And I won't predict the outcome because Edwards can get elected. But it's a nightmare for a Democrat in a red state.
Is Edwards analogous to your former candidate in Georgia, the governor who lost, Governor Barnes?
Yes, he is, except that in Georgia it was more overt racist than it is probably in Louisiana right now because he pulled down the Confederate flag. And that was the number one and only issue. See, he had raised school teachers' pay by huge amounts. He had done a lot of things to reform state government, but none of that seemed to matter. The flag mattered. Well, in Louisiana, nothing seems to matter but Donald Trump. So I don't have a great feeling about it, although I wish I could go down and campaign for Edwards.
877-217-5757. David in Atlanta. Hi, David. You're on with Ray Strother.
Good morning, gentlemen. In Tuesday's edition of the Washington Post, there was a letter to the editor by a gentleman who's the head of a organization supporting Medicare, and he writes that the Republicans have a plan to remove that would affect 59 million seniors and disabled people by turning Medicare into a voucher program where seniors and disabled people would have to go hat in hand to find an insurance company that would accept them. And the benefits, or there's a ceiling to the benefits that the recipient can receive.
What do you think, Ray? Medicare would seem to be election. Something that would have grave political implications for any party or candidate who took on that benefit, which most Americans like and like a lot.
Well, I don't think it'll happen because of that. Remember the most violent protest against Hillary Clinton were people saying, keep your hands off, I'm a conservative, keep your hands off my Social Security. So I don't think the Republicans really, when it gets down to it, they may talk a lot about it, but I don't think they're going to do anything that affects Social Security or Medicare, except maybe make minor adjustments, which are probably needed.
In New York, the talk of the town is a person named Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who until yeah. this week was an unknown throughout the country, and now she will be one of the best-known members of Congress. And she knocked off one of the most prominent members of Congress, a Democrat, Joe Crowley, who outspent her 10-1. And she is a socialist, and she's in her 20s. Ray Strother, is this where the Democratic Party is going?
Well, there were a lot of elections that night, and remember, the same thing happened on the Republican side as happened on the Democratic side. We're so polarized that people Donald Trump endorsed tended to get elected on the Republican side. By that, they won their primaries on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, the most liberal candidate got nominated. Now, we could set her aside a little because of the district she's from. It's a very liberal Democratic district, and whoever gets would have gotten nominated will probably get elected there. And Bernie Sanders did a lot to overcome the stigma of being a socialist Democrat. So I don't think we can isolate her. I think we need to look at the whole country and see the same thing happen. And what we're seeing is a polarization setting in hard.
Ellen in Sherwood. Hi, Ellen. You're on with Ray Strother. Hi, Ellen.
Oh, good morning. Ray, I heard you just say that you wish you could come down to help John Bel Edwards and his campaign. Please do. We need all the help we can get. And I think Kennedy is a phony. He's very disingenuous and untrustworthy.
All right, we're about to go to a break, but Senator Kennedy, as you know, 14 years ago ran for the Senate as a leftist Democrat and lost to David Vitter. He had an epiphany, and it's worked for him, and this is not uncommon in the South. And we'll talk more about it with Ray Strother and also hear from Steve Kearney of Fair Districts, Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Ray Strother with us for a few more minutes, and then we'll hear from Steve Kearney of the Fair Districts Louisiana Group, and he'll comment on the Supreme Court decision this week regarding gerrymandering. But Ray Strother, you worked hand in glove with Governor Buddy Romer, actually were largely responsible for him winning the 1987 campaign, but he had an epiphany and he became a Republican, and it did not work for him, probably in large part because he vetoed two anti-abortion bills that the conservatives didn't like. But his attorney at the time when he was vetoing those bills, providing him advice, was none other than John Neely Kennedy. And Kennedy has had this switch from a left-of-center Democrat to an extremely conservative, not just conservative, but extremely conservative Republican, and it seems to be working for him. Is it because of the times, or is it because Kennedy's a better politician?
An amusing story first. I knew Kennedy, of course, when he worked for Buddy Romer. And in the mornings when I wake about 6 o'clock, I turn on morning television, then I go get a cup of coffee. And I was getting a cup of coffee, it's been a few months ago, and I heard Buddy Romer on television. I said, what? And I went back to the bedroom where the television was, and there was Kennedy. Kennedy sounds exactly like Buddy Romer, which is in no way a criticism of him. But he's the consummate pragmatist, you know. If he could turn into Donald Duck to get elected, I think he'd turn into Donald Duck. But in effect, that would make him a very smart politician. He saw the wave coming, and he jumped ship and went to a new vessel. That's all. It's not surprising. That happened all over the country. But it started in Texas, if I remember. But it's been with Graham. Phil Graham. But anyway, it's been going on for a long time.
Well, thank you, Ray Strother. It is always a delight to talk with you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
See
everybody
you
in Louisiana.
And good luck in Montana, Ray Strother.
Thanks, sir.
We're joined now by Steve Kearney. He is with Fair Districts Louisiana. And this group started a year ago because of the gerrymandering that we have in Louisiana. And I don't think there's any doubt that the district represented by Cedric Richmond is an example of partisan gerrymandering, that it stretches from New Orleans and a little sliver through southern Louisiana, all the way to Baton Rouge, where it takes in North Baton Rouge, Scotlandville, and the airport. And this, of course, makes Garrett Graves' district more conservative than by all rights it should be. After all, we have a Democratic mayor in Baton Rouge. We have a Democratic district attorney. And if the district were drawn that represented East Baton Rouge Parish, we quite likely would have a Democratic congressman or congresswoman. But that's not the way things are. And this week, the Supreme Court had a decision on gerrymandering. And I know that Fair Districts Louisiana was not pleased with it. Steve, what do you think?
Well, in both cases, they declined to rule on the merits of the cases. So there was a case out of Wisconsin in which the Supreme Court decided that the plaintiffs could not bring, did not have standing to bring their case. And in Maryland, which was in which the plaintiffs elected a Democratic gerrymander, they also dismissed it on procedural grounds and did not say whether or not partisan gerrymandering is constitutional.
And with Justice Kennedy retiring, it would seem that it will be an extremely heavy lift to change anything that is currently going on in the court. If not, the court is more likely to be more conservative next year than it is right now.
Yeah, I mean, most of the reform efforts that are happening at the state level anyway. I mean, since there was a partisan gerrymandering case at the Supreme Court, we couldn't help but hope for a strong ruling. But it, you know, the fact that they didn't rule on the merits of the cases doesn't really change anything on what on our calculus at the state level, or on the reform efforts happening all across the nation, across many other states as well.
Now, I recall in 1992, Cleo Fields was elected to Congress, and
yes.
He represented a district that went from Shreveport to Monroe to Alexandria to Baton Rouge. I think it even got in a little bit of Acadiana. It was a Z through the state, and it was designed to ensure a second African-American Democrat to be elected to Congress, and that's exactly what happened. But that district was thrown out. But what's the difference between the Cleo Fields district that was thrown out and the Cedric Richmond district that we have now and the Garrett Graves district that we have now?
I mean, they're definitely not as badly packed as the Cleo Fields one and not as, you know, drawn in a manner of modern art as they are. But it's definitely a case where you have people across all different communities being represented by one single congressman as opposed to having one congressman per community, which might, you know, better represent their interests.
And for those unfamiliar, it's the state legislatures across the country that draw these maps, and the governor who either signs off or objects, and that will be an issue in next year's governor's election because the next census will take place during the term of the next governor and the next legislature. So how important is it to factor that in when people are voting for things to continue as they are or to change?
Well, in most cases, the legislatures draw their districts, but in some cases, commissions do. But yeah, it's definitely true that in Louisiana right now, the state legislature would just draw the maps just like any other bill and have to be signed by the governor. And if you look at, you know, in past maps that have been drawn, more fair maps are drawn when there's a splitting of power. So if you have a Democratic governor or a Republican legislature or vice versa, you find that ridiculous maps aren't drawn as often as when, you know, for instance, after 2010 in Wisconsin, the Republicans had all branches of power, and they just drew maps that were so anti-democratic. Anyone of sound mind and sound body would say so.
877-217-5757 is your number for our guest, Steve Carney of Fair Districts, Louisiana. And Steve, a listener, this is John in the Garden District. John says, look, elections have consequences, as Ray Strother just stated, and as President Obama stated early on in his 2 years or first term in office. With elections having consequences, is it perfectly all right for a legislative majority in a state like Louisiana to determine the districts and how they're drawn and who represents them?
Is it reasonable for our elected officials to basically dilute the power of our vote and infringe on our ability to hear our voices heard in the government? I would say no.
Well, that is what is going on, and I would think that if Democrats had control of the Louisiana legislature as they
did,
they would be doing exactly the same thing.
In fact, the Democrats have an almost worse history of gerrymandering than the Republicans. There's no question that after the 2010 census, the Republicans benefited the most. But in previous eras, the Democrats have done this. And in every era, the incumbents have gerrymandered to entrench their power. So this is not something about any one particular party. This is more about, I'd say, the long-term health of our democracy.
Well, where do you see this going? I mentioned the Supreme Court change. That has a big impact on it. It would seem you're fighting an uphill battle right now.
Well, in states that have a citizens' ballot initiative system, things are moving very quickly. Like, for instance, you have, like, in California and Florida, commissions that draw the districts because they were passed via citizens' ballot initiative. And that's happening right now in places like Michigan. Since Louisiana doesn't have that, we have to appeal directly to the legislature for some manner of reform. And I would agree that it's more of an uphill battle than if we had a ballot initiative system. But we've spoken with some folks who are very open to passing something next year.
Doug on I-10, you're on the air with Steve Kearney of Fair Districts, Louisiana.
Good morning. I can't look at it at the moment, but if memory serves, the previous configuration of the districts in Louisiana was much more geographically organized, if I remember right. And if there's ever a chance to change it, just going back to that would be more representative. You basically had a northwest Louisiana district, a northeast Louisiana district, southeast, et cetera, southwest. The what used to be the 7th congressional district was southwest Louisiana largely. And so in that sense, you would have someone representing their part of the state rather than a strangely drawn sliver of a part of the state.
All right. Thank you, Doug. Your thoughts, Steve?
That's true. I agree. Losing one district after the last census did make things more difficult to draw districts that represented communities. And also, there's a requirement of the Voting Rights Act to have at least one majority-minority district in Louisiana, so that makes it a little more difficult to draw what you would call nice-looking districts. But we can certainly do better than we did last time around.
Well, this is not only a Louisiana issue, it's a national one. And in some of the recent elections, Democrats have outpolled Republicans in overall votes in congressional districts across the country, but yet Republicans have a decided majority in the U.S. House. So we're talking about really a 50-state dilemma right now.
No question. And Pennsylvania is a really good example of that. They just had their districts thrown out by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. But before then, I think it was like a 52-48 state in favor of Democrats, but Republicans had a strong majority in Congress.
Yeah, and in that state, when you say a strong majority, it's like 2-1, isn't it?
Oh, I think Republicans might have 2/3 of the seats, if that serves correctly.
Yeah,
somewhere around there, yeah.
2-1, and yet Democrats are getting 52% of the vote.
Exactly, yeah.
But some would say much of that vote is congregated in the great city of Philadelphia, which is a Democratic stronghold. Should Philadelphia determine what the rest of the state does?
Well, that's true, in that Republicans do have a geographic advantage just because, Democrats are more likely to be located in urban areas and Republicans are more likely to be in rural areas. But it's still possible to do much better than Pennsylvania did when, there was a Republican governor, a Republican legislature, and they just drew these maps that disenfranchised probably most of their citizens.
Well, Steve Kearney, Fair Districts, Louisiana, thank you for joining us today, and I'm sure we'll have occasion to talk again. We'd like that.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
And we'll be joined in short order, if things go according to plan, by the well-regarded journalist Ken Oletta. He's written profiles for The New Yorker since 1992, the author of 11 books. His latest is Frenemies, The Epic Disruption of the Ad Business and Everything Else. We're back after this pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. We switch gears and are now joined by the prolific and esteemed writer Ken Oletta. He's written the Annals of Communications profiles for The New Yorker since 1992, the author of 11 books. His latest is Frenemies, The Epic Disruption of the Ad Business and Everything Else. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning, Jim.
You note that advertising and marketing touch on every corner of our lives, and you say they're the invisible fuel powering almost all media, and there have been major changes. Not only has the technology changed, but advertising and approaches to it have changed, and they're changing our world as we know it.
Totally. And as they get disrupted, as advertising gets disrupted, that's the fuel, as you suggested. And so other industries get disrupted as well. If advertising dies, newspapers die, magazines die, much of TV and radio die. And think about Facebook. 97% of Facebook's revenues come from advertising. 90% of Google's come from advertising. Pods, podcasts, et cetera, apps come from support from advertising. So it's an essential lifeline for the media world we all occupy.
And in America, we are always attracted to the shiny new thing. And you note that one 30-minute Judge Judy episode delivers more seconds of advertising consumed by more people than all of YouTube and all of America in an entire month. And yet people are gravitating toward the shiny new thing. Why?
Well, they, A, it's the shiny new thing. B, it the shiny new thing promises you that we know more in the digital world about the people who are watching our programs on YouTube or actively involved with Facebook. And the more we know about people, the more we can target ads at them and the more we can tell you who watched that ad and then went on to buy your product because they watched that ad. So they're basically telling advertisers this, that we can make this a science. This business of art, we can make a science.
Is that really possible?
Not as possible as they say. Is it more possible than the old legacy media world, the analog media world, where you have a Super Bowl ad and maybe 100 million people were watching television that time, but you don't know who actually watched that ad, for how long they watched that ad, whether they liked that ad, and whether they bought your product after seeing that ad. So increasingly, you certainly know in the digital world how long someone watched an ad. Did they watch the whole ad or part of the ad? With facial recognition, you could actually find out how they facial expressions, whether they respond, how they responded to that ad. Whether you can at some point tell whether someone, after watching that ad, bought that product, that's much more problematic. Because even if they bought the product, it doesn't mean they bought it because they saw that particular ad. And so that becomes one of the loose ends of the argument, digital argument. But there's no question that if you're on Facebook or Google or Amazon, they can better track your behavior than if you watch a show on CBS.
But the numbers are certainly bigger with the old-time media, and we've seen this with newspapers. More people read the printed version, and it gets bigger advertising numbers, but yet the Internet, where you can largely get the product for free, has caused newspapers to have to adjust, and they haven't done a very good job of it, have they?
No, they were very late to understand the digital revolution. When I was covering in the 90s, when the Internet was just starting, and if you went to the Chicago Tribune or the New York Times, they started in the 90s, in the later 90s, to create a digital newspaper. But the digital newspaper was really kind of stupidly done, because they basically said the editor of the print newspaper is the editor of the digital newspaper, A. B, the digital newspaper news could not appear until after it appears in the print paper, which defeats the whole purpose of a 24/7 news operation, which digital allows you to have. So essentially, they were very late to understand how a digital newspaper is very different than a print newspaper. And the other thing they did, they gave it away for free. They didn't charge for it, which in retrospect becomes, not very smart.
No. You note, Ken, that radio in the 1920s and television after World War II became inflection points, as you call them, for new waves of advertising. But the burgeoning Internet at the dawn of the 21st century has become another inflection point. How long is this inflection point going to last?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. I do know that for the advertising community, the question is, Among the questions that will determine the answer to your question is the advertiser is basically saying, we know that particularly on your cell phone, which is the most as personal to you as your wallet or your purse, you don't lend it to someone. And we know that an ad on a cell phone tends to feel like an interruption. So you don't like it, which is why 20% of Americans have ad blockers on their phone, preventing ads. So you say, well, maybe what we have to do, we have so much data, maybe what we have to do is think of not interrupting people with an ad or a sales pitch, but with information that may be useful to them. And so, Ken, you're walking by a store. We know 2 months ago you bought a sport jacket here. If you go into the store now, we'll give you 20% off on your next sport jacket. Mm-hmm. Now, well, I see this as a service to me as wow, that's really valuable. Or will I say, how the hell do you know so much about me? Huh. And should you know so much about me? So one of the questions becomes, will the government at some point, because the public clamors for it, say, we have to have more privacy protections because these people know too much about us and can intrude on our lives? What happens if they know what medications we're doing? Are they going to share that with insurance companies?
Well, you note that big data, big tech is collecting marketing data from our homes on a regular basis.
Oh, I have here. I'm Alexa. My blue light just went on. So Alexa's sitting right at my desk. What does Alexa know about me? That's Amazon's robot, right? What does it know about me? Does it listen in on my conversations, including this one? I don't know.
And as we move into this new realm, we forget that, for example, radio, where we are right now, it has more listeners than television has viewers, than the internet has readers or watchers, whatever you want to call them. And yet radio is lagging way behind these other entities when it comes to advertising revenue. It's partly the shiny new thing, but is there this fascination with trying to target an audience, which you say may not be possible to do, at least not possible to the point that we're told it can do?
Well, you know, digital, in the digital realm, which most radio is not, you have much more information about people, and therefore you could target it. And that's what the advertiser is craving and wanting more of. So one of the reasons why a smaller percentage of ads go to print newspapers or to analog radio or to analog television is because they say they don't have enough data and enough ability to target on people and know who exactly is listening to that radio program or reading that print newspaper. And so that's why there's a movement to get more digitized and therefore being able to serve the interests of advertisers. But as you do that, then you raise the privacy issue.
And the subscription model, which we have referenced for newspapers and magazines, it's going by the wayside, isn't it?
There are those who believe that subscription model could replace the advertising model. I think that's a pipe dream for the following reason. The average American consumer spends $260 a month or thereabout on subscriptions, and that doesn't include, you know, gas and electricity. The one thing Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton agreed on in the 2016 campaign is that the working class, the middle class, the bulk of the American population, their income is frozen for the last dozen or so years. So the thought that they could suddenly start spending more to replace free advertising, 2.2 billion people who get Facebook for free are going to suddenly pay for it? No way. It's not going to happen.
And one of the overriding themes in your book is that we now know what people purchase, what they eat, what they read, what they watch, their interests, their hobbies, their age, sex, neighborhood. It's impossible to be anonymous in this world we're living in today, isn't it?
It is, but the question then becomes, is there a point at which the public, as has happened in Western Europe, says, you know too much about me, and I don't want to give you access to my cookies the way you have it now. And if the public rises up and says that, then the government would rise up and say that, and they would try and step in and protect privacy. If that happens, that changes the advertising business and the economy of it.
Well, Ken Oletta is one of the most prominent and prolific journalists of our time, and his latest work is an important one. His 11th book, Frenemies, The Epic Disruption of the Ad Business and Everything Else. And it's been a pleasure to talk with you today. Thank you, Ken. And
Thank you, Jim.
Congratulations on your book. Ken Oletta joining us from New York. Walter Isaacson is a wholesale endorser of Ken's book, the man from New Orleans who's been with us a time or two and is a fabulous journalist in his own right. And we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Until then, for Ali Baltazar, I'm Jim Inkster. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.